From the Sky News Centre at 5, detectives looking for the architect Joanna Yates are examining CCTV cameras in the area where she went missing. The 25-year-old was last seen buying a pizza from a Tesco Express in Bristol a week ago. Police haven't yet been able to trace the item of food. Chief Superintendent John Stratford says they're trying not to speculate on what might have happened to her.
This is still a missing person investigation, and we continue to hope that there's some kind of explanation behind this and that we will find her safe and well and return her back to her family.
In the past few minutes, we've heard a coach has overturned near Norwich Airport, trapping some of its passengers. Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service says 49 people, mainly elderly, are on board and five have serious injuries. The bus is believed to have skidded on ice and rolled over on the A140 near Horsford. A man called Alex Blackburn-Smith is wanted by police over the mauling of a woman in South London by a dog. He's believed to be the owner of the Belgian Mastiff, which attacked Barbara Williams at her home in Wallington last night. The Department of Health says the number of people in intensive care with confirmed or suspected flu in England is not cause for concern. However, Chief Medical Officer Dame Sally Davis says it's slightly worrying that a fair number who are suffering are young people. 460 are being given a high level of treatment, most of them aged between 16 and 64.
The other worry is, of course, if we've got so many in critical care, does the NHS have the capacity to cope? And we planned for this, and it's less than 15% of the critical care beds as they're standing at the moment, and the NHS has plenty of capacity and capability.
A new strain of the superbug MRSA has been detected on the Isle of Man. Health bosses say it predominantly affects young, fit and healthy people. A small number of cases of MRSA USA 300 have been confirmed on the island. And Christmas Eve could become the luckiest day of the year for 25 people tonight. The National Lottery is guaranteed it will create 25 millionaires in a special raffle jackpot. Each person will win £1 million. That's the latest. I'm Dave Terrace.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Mr. Jones is at home, wrapping Christmas presents. I say, Mr. Jones, are you all ready for the Yuletide festivities?
Yes, I think so.
Are you really sure, Mr. Jones? Really, really sure?
Well,
would you know who to call if you smelt gas at home? Just as I thought, Mr. Jones. You're not ready at all, are you?
Perhaps.
If you smell gas, call the National Gas Emergency Service on 0800 111 999. And remember, Mr. Jones, gas safety isn't just for Christmas, it's for life. Smell gas? Don't risk it. Call 0800 111 999. Save it to your home and mobile phone.
On the 5th of April 1994, Forest of Dean television playwright Dennis Potter made his last ever TV appearance. He was interviewed by Melvyn Bragg in what was a broadcast of great poignancy and power. A victim of terminal cancer, Dennis Potter knew he had only a few weeks to live.
How did you and when did you find out that you'd got this cancer?
Well, I knew for sure on St. Valentine's Day. It was like a little gift, a little kiss from somebody or something. I had a lot of pain before then. And there was a quite accidental sort of misdiagnosis of a condition in London here when I was on the wing on something, and an assumption being made that initially it was an ulcer and then spastic colon and all that sort of thing, which meant, unfortunately, because Margaret, my wife, was ill and I was unwilling to leave her at that time, so I was not mixing up doctors, that I had December and January in particular, I was trying to control what in effect I now realize was pain of cancer with Panadol, which is ludicrous. So in a way it was almost a relief to find out what it was, cancer of the pancreas with a secondary cancers already in the liver, and the knowledge that it can't be treated, you know, is no neither chemotherapy nor surgery are appropriate. It's just simply analgesic care until you know, good night Vienna, as they say in football, I believe nowadays. And I've been working since then, flat out, at strange hours, because I'm done in the evenings, mostly because of the morphine. Also, the pain is very energy-sapping. But I do find that I can be at my desk at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I'm keeping to a schedule of pages, and I will and do meet that schedule every day. I had to attend to my affairs as well. I remember reading that phrase when I was a kid, that he had time to attend to his affairs. But what it did give me also is, as a child, without question, I know for a fact, and there's no argument about this, that I was a coward, you know, physical coward. And often, I'm really cripplingly shy person, actually. I hate new situations, new people, almost a dread. Now, those two consequences in your adult life can really create serious wrong impressions of yourself to yourself and of yourself to other people, because you try and compensate for what you know. A, you're a coward. B, you're shy. So that can lead to aggression and a sort of the reverse of shy, the arrogance, if you like, because you're wearing it like a cloak in order to get through that particular. But to have to let that drop and find out that, in fact, at the last, thank God, you're not actually a coward, you know, and that I haven't shed a tear since I knew. I grieve for that my family and friends who know me closest, obviously, and they're going through it in a sense more than I am, you know. But I discover also what you always know to be true, but you never know it until you know it. If you follow, sorry, I got my voice is echoing in my head for some reason. I think it was actually to you that I remember Martin Amis saying something about you reach 40s, your 40s or a middle age, and nobody ever tells you, nobody's ever told you, you know, what it's like. Well, it's the same about knowing about death. We're the one animal that knows we're going to die, and yet we carry on, you know, paying our mortgages, doing our jobs, moving about, behaving as though there's eternity in a sense. And we forget, or tend to forget, that life can only be defined in the present tense. It is, and it is now only, you know. I mean, much as we would like to call back yesterday, and indeed yearn to and ache to sometimes, we can't. It's in us, but we can't actually, it's not there in front of us. And however predictable tomorrow is, and unfortunately for most people, most of the time, it's too predictable. You know, they're locked into whatever situation they're locked into. Even so, no matter how predictable it is, there's the element of unpredictable. You don't know. The only thing you know for sure is the present tense. And that nowness becomes so vivid to me now that it's almost, in a perverse sort of way, I'm almost serene. You know, I can celebrate life. Below my window in Ross, when I'm working in Ross, for example, there now at this season, the blossom is out in full now, there in the west early. There's a plum tree. It looks like apple blossom, but it's white. And looking at it, instead of saying, oh, that's nice blossom, you know, now, the last week, looking at it through the window when I'm writing, it is the whitest, frothiest, blossomest blossom that there ever could be, you know. And I can see it. And things are both more trivial than they ever were and more important than they ever were. And the difference between the trivial and the important doesn't seem to matter. But the nowness of everything is absolutely wondrous. And if people could see that, you know, there's no way of telling you. You have to experience it, you know. But the glory of it, if you like, the comfort of it, the reassurance, if not that I'm interested in reassuring people, you know, bugger that. The fact is that if you see the present tense, boy, do you see it. And boy, can you celebrate it, you know?
You said earlier that it wasn't to do with believing that life was eternal, but have you any feeling that from
position you're in that it might be? You said that you've never quite thrown off the idea of believing in God, and it features in a lot of your
Work. I don't know about... Yeah, God's a rumour, if you like. God is... I mean, this kind of Christianity, or indeed any other religion, that is a religion because of fear of death, or hope that there is something beyond death, does not interest me. I thought, you know, what kind of cruel old bugger is God if it's terror that is the, you know, is the ruling edifice, if you like, the structure of religion? And too often, for too many people, it is. Now, that to me isn't religion. Religion has always been, I've said it before, it doesn't matter that I repeat myself, I won't get many more chances to repeat myself, thank God, but the religion to me has always been the wound, not the bandage, you know. I don't see the point of not acknowledging the pain and the misery and the grief of the world. And if you say, ah, but God understands, or through that you come to a greater appreciation, I mean, I then think, well, you nasty old sod. You know, if that's God, that's not God, that's not my God, that's not how I see God. I see God in us, or with us, if I see at all. Some shreds and particles and rumors, some knowledge that we have, some feeling why we sing and dance and act, why we paint, why we love, why we make art, you know. All the things that separate us from the purely animal in us are palpably there. And you can call them what you like, and you can theologize about them, and you can build great structures of belief about them. The fact is they are there, and I have no means of knowing whether that there-ness in some sense doesn't cling to what I call me.
Do you spend much time thinking about your childhood and raking through that, Dennis, and the time in the Forest of Dean, the time with your parents?
I think any writer does. In particular, right, but I think everybody does. But I think in particular...
Because you've written about it often. Where is it now, as it were, in your...
Where the Forest of Dean is still back there. It's a sort of mythic Forest of Dean. There's the real one, with the same signs and stresses as the real anywhere. And there's the other one, the one I grew up as a small child in, and the... those rather ugly villages in beautiful landscape, and just accidentally a heart-shaped place between two rivers, somehow slightly cut off from then the rest of England and Wales on the far side, the other border, which is why, as a border person, I always hate the Welsh, and inevitably, you know, because I was brought up to... Yeah, many of my friends who are... But the Race Relations Act cannot touch me here. You know, I'm a border person, and that's the way it is.
Do you look back at it? I mean, a lot of people think that you see your childhood in... there are terrors in it, but it is some kind of place in England that was a particular period in the lives of a lot of people,
yeah,
which was to do with a sense of community. Now, we've both been through that, and we know that things were wrong, awful, terrible, and so on, but there's a glow there. Is it a glow because you're a middle-aged man looking
back?
Well,
it's partly that,
yeah,
and it's truth, the fact about childhood, which I tried to do in things like Blue Remembered Hills, yeah, for example. I used adult actors to play children in order to make them like a magnifying glass to show what it's like. Because if you look at a child, they talk about present tense, that's all a small child lives in, you know. So a wet Tuesday afternoon, for example, can actually be years long. Childhood is full to the brim of fear, horror, excitement, joy, boredom, love, anxiety, lose. I remember losing a pen. You know, the sleepless, the anxiety. You know, I lost my pen. Oh my God, I've lost my. I mean, the penness of that pen and the lostness of that loss is so great in child. Maybe you kind of revert to that in a way, you know. But my Forest of Dean childhood, well, it is a strange and beautiful place with a. People were as warm as anywhere else, but they seem warmer to me, and the accent is almost so strong, it's almost like a dialect. Now, where was I going? Oh, buddy, I don't know, you know, Chunders Icon and Bjunt and all that, you know. And up the hill, twice actually, usually on a Sunday, sometimes three times to Salem Chapel, and the and those little floppy covered, orange covered hymn book, Ira Sankey's 1,200 Sacred Songs and Solos, and all those, which numbers would be slotted up on the board, like, you know, those choruses, like, it's one, 20. It's funny, I can think of the number before I can think of the chorus. I can see it as clear as it were written in front of me on the slat, 787, hymn number 787. Will there be any stars in my crown when the evening sun goes down, when I wake with the blessed in the mansion of rest? Will there be any stars in my crown? And of course, it makes me laugh, and yet it tugs at me, and I see it. I see those little kids' faces singing, will there be any stars in my, any star? It's repeated, any stars in my crown? And countless numbers of such things. And for me, of course, the language of the New Testament in particular, but the Bible in general, was actually, as it is to a child, I suppose even to a child brought up in Pinner or Wembley Park, it must be something similar, but it was the Holy Land, you know. I knew where Cannock Ponds, by the pit where Dad worked, I knew that was where Jesus walked on the water, you know. I knew where the Valley of the Shadow of Death was, you know, that lane with the overhanging trees where you, as I said, I was a coward, you know, at dusk I'd whistle, you know, going down that particular lane. But where, I'm grateful for that language in a way, A, that dialect, B, that time in a sense, where of course it's the war time, we were poor, yeah, Dad was a coal miner, so he didn't go in because he was reserved occupation, therefore he was not in the army. They were in those, they've all closed now, those deep mine pits in the Forest Dean. There were five of them when I was a child, you know, deep shaft pits. But they were pick and shovel pits as well, you know, bloody hard work, grinding, shift work, grinding work. And there were, you know, no water closets or, you know, and the tin bath brought in front of the coal fire and so on the Friday night and all that. And men walking home with their coal dirt on them, you know. But the whole country at that time was politicized. Even children knew what the war was about. I mean, we did. And there's a lot of rewriting of history. There always is. Revisionist history always comes along. People say this, that, and they make... We British in general, English in particular, I find the use of the word British harder and harder to use as time passes. English tend to deride ourselves far too easily because we've lost so much confidence, because we lost so much of our own sense of identity, which had been subsumed in this false imperial identity, which I also obviously hate. But we were at that time both a brave and a steadfast people, and we shared an aim, a condition, a political aspiration, if you like, which was shown immediately in the 1945 general election, and then one of the great governments of British history, that those 5-6 years of creating what is now being so brutally and wantonly and callously dismantled was actually a period to be proud of. And I'm proud of it. Nervous smoking.
Thank God
I don't have to go to America anymore. But I remember asking a waiter in America breakfast for an ashtray as he was turning away, and it was just as though I'd shot him in the back. You know, it's easier to pull a gun in America than a cigarette out of your pocket. But I like to go in the... there is a remnant left on the train. I do, of course, travel first class. I mean, I enjoy money and spending it. I mean, money, I have one, I like it, you know. But I like, in the remnant of the first class train intercity, there is one bit for smokers. And I love to, if I see people sitting there without a cigarette, I love to say, you do know this is a smoking compartment, don't you? Because I've heard so many, you do know you're not allowed to smoke here. But of course now, I'm just virtually chain smoking, because there's no point in, there's so many things like, I can't keep food down anymore. I can't have a meal. You know, my digestive system's gone. But I can drink things, and those prepared, those horrible chemical things with all the minerals and stuff in them. But I can add a dash of this and that to it, which I do. And like cream, like cholesterol. Oh, and, you know, but I can break any rule now. You know, I can. But the cigarette, well, I love stroking this lovely tube of delight. Look at it.
I was packed in. Just don't be smoking again in a minute, Dennis. It's been written about so much and derided so much. People from working class backgrounds getting to Oxford and doing what?
Yeah.
All university, but in your case, Oxford. And yet, that little journey is not an easy one to make.
It's
is
a
it?
Long journey. Yeah. It shouldn't be easy, but any journey from adolescence to adulthood is a long one.
What did it do to you? Do you think going from the Forest of Dean to it's a big jump? I know.
Well, I'd already made a jump in one sense to London. You know, my mother was a Londoner, and her mother was a Forest of Dean woman. You see, who, as in the parlance of the time, went into service. That was, you know, it was a skivvy and a drudge, a servant in a London house, and met a Fulham plumber and married him, and then my mother's mother. I mean. And had the usual 11, 12 kids and all that. My mother used to come down to the Forest of Dean to visit her mother's family and with her mother. And one weekend she met this young... My dad was he was such a gentleman, my father. He died in 1975. I still have a very good... I have a better relationship with him than I could manage, as it were, at the time of the later stages of my so-called journey from grammar school to Oxford and all that meant, which sort of slightly intimidated him. You know?
What do you mean about a better relationship?
A better relationship in the sense that I see more and I feel that I understand more of his gentleness and of his desire to reach me, and I feel that it's being reached. I can't put it in any other... For example, the things he used to be almost scared of me when I didn't want him to be, and I used to feel irritation about that, which I didn't want to feel. You know, those sort of things. And I'd be writing in this little downstairs room, because I've always had this passion for... I have this antique, you know, I'm not ashamed now of being able to say it is an antique word, and it's one that's easily scoffed at. But I do have a sense of vocation, and I have it to the... I will have it to the last ounce of my life, the last second. I have the sense, and I'm proud that I've got it, and I'm no longer ashamed of saying, yes, I have had a sense of vocation. And it was writing. And he would sort of hover in the doorway or lean against the door jamb and say, so all right, our dad? I'm writing. So I'd be irritated because I'd go in and talk to him later. I was finishing something, or I was doing, or I was engaged in something. Yes, Dad, yeah, I'm sure, you know, all that. So sure, it's all right, mind, all but, you know, that anxiety to communicate, but doing it wrongly. But it now, of course, I'd say, you know, come on in, Dad, for Christ's sake, sit down, let, you know, it doesn't matter about that now, that minute, you know. But of course, I can't. And yet there's a sense in which by even saying it, you see, I've done it, I've said it, come on in, Dad. Mm. And he and I can feel him genetically in me, and I see the waste of so much of his life because of the system that he lived through. You know, he was shy, he was gentle, he was a bit feckless in many ways. If he had he'd always say, a pound in your pocket is your best friend, but of course, as soon as he had one, it'd be drinks all around in the pub, and much to my mother's dismay, you know, but he was that kind of, you know, come on, let's got to have one, you know, that kind of man. And I plug into that now more easily. That's all I can say, you know.
Do you think that you've had your driving themes in your work have come from this part of your childhood, or did they come from what happened after the break to university and the first few years university journalism?
I don't know, Melvin. They come as you grow, yeah. And your childhood remains. I mean, I've forgotten who said it, but I remember reading some essay by some writer saying that for any writer, the first 14 years of his or her life are the crucible anyway, no matter what you do, you know. But of course you add on and you use your experiences. And I've always deliberately, as a device, used the equivalent of a novelist's first-person narrative. You know, when the novelist says I, you know he doesn't mean I, and yet you want him to mean I, you know. And I've used, for example, in The Singing Detective, I used the Forest of Dean, I used the physical circumstances of psoriatic arthropathy, which, you know, still, you know, and I still got bloody psoriasis itching away at me, which is a bug. You'd think that would lay off now, wouldn't you? But it won't. But I used that and geographical realities. And it seemed so personal then, you know, that I often do that. It isn't. I make it up. The story, you know, the wife thing, the you know, the whole inner structure of that man is different to me. Now, he was a man, the Singing Detective, Michael Gambon character, Philip Marlowe, in a hospital bed at the beginning, who had nothing. He was stripped of everything. He had no faith in himself, no belief in any political, religious, or social system. He was full of a witty despair and cynicism. Now, I have never been like that. And the dramatic story was very simple. It was simply seeing a man pick up his bed and walk. It's interesting, I always fall back into biblical language, but that again, you see, is part of my heritage, which I, in a sense, am grateful for.
Do you feel you were thought of at one stage as a political writer at a very early stage? Your first appearance on television was talking about class to some...
Yeah.
In some documentary program.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
Then yeah. Stand up Nigel Barton, you stood as a Labour candidate, you worked for the Daily Herald and so on. Yeah. Where does that figure now, Dennison? When did it figure? Was it a...
Well, it was part of the... It's a sort of subverted... You know, like there's... In pain, there's such a thing as sort of referred pain.
Yeah.
And so on. It was part of the process of finding what writing was about. It was the same thing, really. To me, at Oxford, when I was... The only way I could sort of express it then, you know, via ISIS and articles, and I wrote a piece for the New Statesman when I was an undergraduate, things like that, and I realized that somewhere along the line my pen was actually going to provide me with a living, you know. Politics seemed the gateway. My very first book I wrote as an undergraduate, although a printing strike delayed it until a year after I left Oxford, it came out in 1960.
The Glittering Coffin,
yeah. Yes, which was a kind of metaphor for the condition of England. Typical young man's title, you see, a typical piece of that sort of humbugging, canting rhetoric, which young men, bless their hearts, specialize in. You know, I think we should always look back on our own past with a sort of tender contempt, as long as the tenderness is there. But also, please let some of the contempt be there, because we know what we're like. We know how we hustle and bustle and shove and push. And you sometimes use grand words to cloak it, you know. One does. I'm not looking at you specifically, so don't squirm.
Just associating with
that. Politics seemed the door, you know, until I actually stood as a candidate. By then, of course, illness had descended, and I had a walking stick, and I was... drowning, felt that I was on the Daily Herald. I hated every second of it, and that world of popular journalism as I saw it then, you know, and the Herald eventually mutated through the mismanagement of the Mirror Group, its eventual owners, into that's an interesting thing. As a writer, you will know that one of the favourite fantasy plots of a writer is a character's told, you've got 3 months to live, which is what I was told, and you, who would you kill? Because you've got every, you know, and I call my cancer, the main one, the pancreas one, I call it Rupert, so I can get close to it, because that man, Murdoch, is the one who, if I had the time, in fact, I've got too much writing to do and I haven't got the energy, but I would shoot the bugger if I could. There is no one person more responsible for the pollution of what was already a fairly polluted press. And the pollution of the British press is an important part of the pollution of British political life. And it's an important part of the cynicism and misperception of our own realities that is destroying so much of our political discourse.
You do feel the state of decay is deeply set in, don't you?
I do, with great regret and pity and a feeling of shame, of self-shame too. But it's rescuable, just. It's up to people to stand up and shout a bit. Not to turn it into cynicism, which is, I'm afraid, what is happening. Politics is still crucially important. Our choices are vital, and we've got to make them. And not just say, oh, they're all the same. They are all the same in certain ways, alas. The political animal is such an animal. But the ideas behind it, the concepts lurking somewhere behind their rhetoric and their spittle and so on, are important choices that we should make.
Do you think the overall sense of decay that you've talked about stems from political decay, or political decay stems from other powerful symptoms?
Both. They interlace. The press and politics. The commercialization of everything means, of course, you're putting a commercial value upon everything, and you turn yourself from a citizen into a consumer. We're not citizens, we're consumers, and politics is a commodity to be sold. And that is what is happening. And look what's happening at the BBC. Look what is happening to television in general. Look who owns it. The arguments done by respectable liberal commentators, liberal small-hour commentators about size, the economies of scale and so on, they're all actually nonsense. A program costs what a program costs to make. It can be made by a tiny company. What they're talking about is ownership of the means of communications. And they're talking about the mass media, as J.B. Priestley coined the phrase. They're talking about political control in the end. They're talking, how can we have a mature democracy when newspapers and television, whether standard television, cable television, are beginning to be so interlaced in ownership terms? Where are our freedoms to be guaranteed? Who is going to guarantee them? Look at the effects of all these takeovers, and it's not about programs. Now, the world that you and I came into television or radio, when we came into it, I'm not saying that world wasn't paternalistic, I'm not saying it can be preserved as it was, and I'm not saying there mustn't be change, but that world was based upon a set of assumptions that are almost now derisible, laughable. Like in politics, certain statements become derisable. We're destroying ourselves by not making those statements, just as we're destroying our television. Week by week, day by day, I see it. If I were starting out now, as I did, my first television program was in 1960, that documentary about the Forest of Dean. My first television plays were in 1965, and I had this burst of energy through illness. When I reinvented myself quite consciously as an act, I was so out of it. I obviously had lost my job. I had two small kids and a third on the way. And I wrote this television play, and they liked it, thank God, and commissioned another. And I was given the space to grow into, and I gave my working life to it as a result. And I have stayed with television to such a large extent because of that. Whereas if I were starting now, where would I get that chance? Who would cosset and look after or see? Where is the single play? Well, and the series, you can punch the buttons in the predictability. You can call the shot numbers out in advance. The formula-ridden television is because of sales, because the nerves they'll soon have, where they'll tell every 5 seconds who's switching off. The pressure upon creators, whether they're writers, directors, designers, actors, producers, whatever, that pressure will be all the time to maximize your audience at any given point, which is the very antithesis of discovering something you didn't know. It's the very antithesis of the kind of broadcasting and television which was such a glory in British life.
But given what was done in the 60s and 70s on television, and given the power and influence of television, and given the fact that people came through from good schools and burgeoning universities, let's be a bit Panglossian about that. Given that, why do you think it turned so sharply in the mid-80s and the country was and people were available to being turned round and in a sense turned over?
Because there needed to be some stripping out of things. There needed to be change. We were conscious of the need for change. And for a change in British politics, like a 45 government in a way, there was a genuine radicalism in the air. It was coming from the right. But then it became that everything was given, in a sense, its price tag. And the price tag became the only gospel. And that gospel, in the end, is a very thin gruel indeed. And if you start measuring humankind in those terms, everything else then becomes secondary or less important or, in some sense, as I say, laughable. And all the things that bind us as a community, whether it's, and they're partly right-wing things, you know. Sometimes I get out of bed and I don't know whether I'm right-wing or left-wing, to be honest, you know, because I feel the pull of both. I feel the pull of tradition and the love, and I love my land. I love England. I mean, when I'm abroad, that's one of the things, I don't have to do that anymore. But I genuinely feel homesick. I mean for an idea almost, you know. And I've always loved my country, but not at the expense, not of flags and drums and trumpets and billowing Union Jacks and busbied soldiers and the monarchy and the pomp and the circumstance and all that, but the real something about our people that I come from and therefore respond to, and I expect other people to do it of their own backgrounds and nations and cultures too. But those things are very difficult to put prices upon and to quantify in the terminology of Mrs. Thatcher and her successors and the current government. And the, you know, they will use phrases like community care when they mean get closed that costly thing and put that madman onto the street. And then if it's in front of their noses, they'll do another temporary makeshift measure and claim that things are getting better, or that the per-head spending has gone up. So what? It may have done. But what has actually happened? What is actually happening when a young person in many, many, many a town in this country sees no prospect of a job, and then they say, they will moralize, that's the worst thing, and say, oh, crime is everything to do with the criminal. What does a life of not expecting to get work, what is a life of only expecting cynicism in political conversation, what is a life that sees no horizon further than the latest nasty video and the cable TV and the Murdochs and the Sun, you know? Look, just pick up a copy of The Sun and say, is this Britain? Is this what we've done to ourselves? Are these people, the people who work on that paper, how can they go home and face their families without any sense of shame? You know, I'd be shamed to the pit of my guts if I were forced to do, and some of them are, to be fair, forced to do it. So they don't want to be unemployed. They want to earn. They need to earn. Some of them do things that they are appalled by what they do. I know that. I've met some of them. I know they are. But my God, what a system.
In your own writing, there was a time, and when it seemed to me and to a lot of people, really, that there were novels being written and plays being put on stage and films being made, but the power of very good writers, directors, cameramen talking to a large public was on television, and you were pushing it again and again. You were bringing up ideas of the devil, you were bringing up ideas of dialogue turning into singing, you were bringing up ideas of memory matching with fantasy and so on. You obviously found television available to everything you wanted to do, and you made it available for a lot of other people.
It could be and can be, and I reached a stage, and I've written so many things now, and it's over so many years of working for television, obviously. I'm 58. I might reach my 59 on May the 17th. I might get, and I do, it could have been looked neater, wouldn't it? 59. But technique, I don't think about anymore. It's just natural to me. I don't even, it's like, with a musician.
What about subject matter? Is there anything, did you feel that you were being daring doing any of the things you did in that? Did you think, I am now going
That's
to
That's the only thing I really resent. The only thing I would stamp my foot about, this is, I'm going to say the gospel truth here, I go again, but this is the truth, Melvin, is that I have never felt the need to do that. It has come, the mold, if broken on any one point, has come out of the need to do what I was doing. Not, how do I break the mold? It's the other way around. So things have happened the way they come. I remember, it always sounds so mundane, but for example, the use of adults to play children in Blue Remembered Hills I was starting to write about children, and I wanted to write something difficult, because children don't have long speeches, you can't have flashbacks to non-existent memories, you can't have certain rhetorical devices, you have to have a continual twitchy action, because that's how children move. These are a group of seven-year-olds. And the only way I could see, while keeping exactly to the language of childhood and the movements of childhood and the constant present tense preoccupations of childhood, to show it without that filter coming in the way, which an audience going, children, and immediately pushing it back to childhood, was by using seven adult actors. Once you get over the panic of the first 5 minutes, when I was watching, thinking, oh my God, is this going, Colin Welland with his great fat ass and his great shorts waddling, sploshing through mud, making airplane noises and chewing on an apple, I thought, it's going to be one of those dire dread embarrassments, because it ain't going to work. And yet people could see that it was, after a while, people could see obviously that these were adults. Obviously, that goes without saying. But they also saw that they were children. And then, so it worked. But it wasn't because I was trying... You see what I'm getting at? I was trying to show childhood, not at one remove, but straight on.
What about bringing in popular songs, as you did say, Penis from Heaven?
I wanted to write about... in a sense, it sounds condescending. I don't mean it quite this way. I wanted to write about the way popular culture is an inheritor of something else, that cheap songs, so-called, actually do have something of the Psalms of David about them. They do say the world is other than it is. They do illuminate odd. This is why people say, listen, they're playing our song or whatever. It's not because that particular song actually expressed the depth of the feelings that they felt when they met each other and heard it. It is that somehow it re-evokes and pours out of them yet again, but with a different coating of irony and self-knowledge, those feelings come bubbling back. So I wanted to write about popular songs in a direct way, so it became just a technical problem for me. I thought, not interested in writing a musical. A musical has a different grammar whatsoever. The action builds to a song and the song caps it and then it moves on, and the song is, has a different function in a musical. Is how do I get that music from way down there in the back or here in the ear or at the side? How do I get it straight bang up in front? And then I thought, lip sync things now and again, sometimes there's a bad performance or they dub from one language to another that way. Why don't I just try making the actor move his lips to the words of the song and see if it, then I tried it a bit. I tried it with myself in a mirror, and that was fun. And I was a great singer. In fact, it was like pre-karaoke, again, rather than looking, I wasn't breaking a mold as such. I just found the ideal way of making these songs so real.
Just like
and I can understand it, the use of this word controversial. But there were many times, but let's take a couple of the times when you really seem to bump into opinion in this country. You're on this most popular, extraordinary medium of television, which was doing things in the 60s and 70s in this country, and in many areas which people had never dreamt it could do, in terms of original writing, in your case, in terms of... Well, it was reaching out in all directions, let's leave it at that. And taking on the public in a big way. There were can we talk about two times you really sort of bumped into them? One was to do with when you brought the notion of the devil, we're talking brimstone and treacle, the notion of the devil. Another was to do with sex in Black Eyes. Now, somehow it seems to be these two things are directly related, but let's talk about them one at a time. What do you think was happening in the brimstone and treacle row, and then in the business of sex on television?
Brimstone and treacle was... can I break off for a second? I need a swig of that. There's liquid morphine in that thing. And I'll keep going, but
why do you think you got so much resistance in Brimstone and Treacle?
That's a very complicated story. But if I could put it in the essence is I saw what I was trying to do. You know, it's a simple flip over of an ordinary sentimental religiose rather than religious parable, in that there is an afflicted house, variously afflicted, but in particular with a crippled, seemingly mindless, struck young girl, and there is a visitor, and the visitor brings her to life, makes her speak. Now, if that visitor were an angel, then that's all you would have, is sanctimoniousness. You would learn nothing about anything. And I chose in my head, and this is how it began, this is why I'm talking this way, it began in my head as like that. What if it were the devil? Instead of making that easy distinction, which, on the whole, only the blasphemous make, non-religious people make this distinction very easily between so-called good, so-called evil, when, of course, they are interrelated. One is defined in terms of the other. One cannot exist without the other, which is why a Satan was an angel, you know. And all... art of any kind has attempted to deal with this, has had to deal with it, the dualism of it. So instead of the angel coming and rescuing the cripple and the dumb and the afflicted, I had the devil do it. And an evil act can lead to good consequences. A good act can lead to evil consequences. This is often the case, and it is incomprehensible. It is as though, you know, the rain falls on the just and upon the unjust. It is so. Now, it appeared disgusting because it was a devil and because it was a rape, or the beginnings of a rape that made her cry out. And interestingly, the cry out was actually an accusation against her father. That complexity is, as I say, simply a reversal of what would have been sanctimonious and sentimental. Now, that is what offended and afflicted people. I remember Alistair Milne, who was then director of programmes television at the time, saying that letter to me, something like brilliantly made and written, so and so, but nauseating, diabolical, exactly the right word. It was diabolical. It was meant to be. Nauseating, not in the sense that he meant, nauseating in the sense of making you think about those forces, those circumstances, those afflictions, and the way we manipulate the words good and bad. That, to me, is what it was about.
It did. Strange that should be banned, isn't it, in a way? No. I wanted to pursue it.
Mrs. Whitehouse wanted me prosecuted for blasphemy after Son of Man about Jesus. Because my Jesus was, if you like, a Forest of Dean Jesus, who could feel the wood on the cross before his crucifixion, like, know that it was good timber. And then almost weep at the uses that man, cruel man, puts timber instead of making tables and chairs and useful things. They kill other men with it. And because he was that sort of Jesus, and there are millions of Jesuses, obviously, and mine was just one of them. But there also in the, there was a row in the Australian Parliament about it. You know, things like that. And I think, well, if people get so conditioned that they'll watch these endless pappy series, you know, without any... There's violence every 20, 30 seconds, whatever the audience rating system demands. There's sex used just like that, bang, you know. There are constant sanctimonious references to God or the good, you know. If you try and make people see the real use of these words, they get hopping mad sometimes, but so be it. But that's what television is for, too. The accusation by quite intelligent people that I was a misogynist really hurt me, because I know I'm not. And the trouble is all political and ideological movements have labels and party lines, which some people just spill out when necessary. The very intelligent feminists, the Kathy Ackers of this world, and although I don't know whether feminists would now call Germaine Greer a feminist or not, I admire her because she visibly changes her mind about things and writes from her own experience. I've never met her. Writes from her own physical and emotional experiences about what she really feels and therefore what she thinks about the world. And she could see, I mean, she said something very rude. I mean, it was on television that I saw it, you know, that he might be as an uptight little, but he's actually telling the truth. So I was relieved that people like that could see, but I was amazed by a number of intelligent women. Now, for example, what would have happened if that had been Black Eyes by Denise Potter? Obviously, karaoke is a metaphor, you know, the way there's the music and you have your little line, you can sing it, and everything is written for you. And that is the way life appears to a lot of people and feels to a lot of people. Some of you haven't got much space, and even the space you've got, although you use your own voice, the words are also written for you, you know. So I'm using that as the metaphor, and I was on the point of delivering it. Then this terrible, as soon as I knew I was going to die, I said, I can't deliver this. You know, this, whatever I'm doing now is my last work. And I want it to be fitting. I want it to be a memorial, you know. I want to speak. I want to continue to speak. And at the same time, you see, I have this, to me, a very exciting idea. I mean, I would say that, but I do feel the excitement of it with Channel 4. Which I'm calling Cold Lazarus, and you'll see why. I'm trying to join two things that are currently in the air together. One is that virtual reality, you know, where you put on goggles and a pair of gloves and you can actually, well, obviously you land a plane simulated, or you can begin to have, they hope, this is the commercial money behind it, you can almost feel that you're having sex with Marilyn Monroe or somebody, you know what I mean. But the computer world, virtual reality, will it so invade, A, the entertainment business, but B, your own senses of reality, and you can use it in work, you know, in architecture, in whatever, that it is very, very, very much a thing of the future that is going to influence a lot of the ways we think about, we know, what we know about ourselves. And the other is, you know, using cryogenics, that is deep freeze, that is the technology at absolute zero temperatures, where, of course, it would be in California, where every nut rolls sooner or later. They are actually freezing bodies of people, very rich people on the point, and there's some very corporations making quite a lot of nice money out of this, freezing very rich people for eventual regeneration when they can cure whatever it is they died of. Now they've now honed that down now, I discovered. They only need to freeze the head, so you just have the head and they will regenerate with hope. They've managed, apparently, to regenerate some frozen rat brain cells, which is interesting. But I have this series, you see, where there's the head in its case, and all the electrodes are attached to it. And as they gradually thaw and simulate the billions upon billions of brain cells to discover that he's alive, and there is a memory there somewhere, real memory. And we're now talking about 400 years from now. And that real memory is of the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, 60s. In other words, my memories, or what I choose to make of my memories. And in order to stimulate those memories, they have to use virtual reality memories as well. Now, a high mogul type, the entertainment business, God knows what it would be like then, but a Murdoch successor, you know, when you can imagine entertainment really is the function of the world. Wall to wall, everything helmeted, or people won't know what's real and what isn't. Looking at the monitors that are plugged into these real memories of those distant days of 400 years ago, and the strange world in which people could walk safely in the streets and things like that, suddenly realizes he's onto an absolute winner, you know, with they plug this into the nightly entertainment, these real memories. And of course the man by then knows, although he's just ahead, that and wants the truth that we need to be mortal, we need to die, and he wants to. But now he's part of the entertainment business, and his real memories mixed up with not a satire, but mix up with the world as though, you know, is the Brave New World or 1984 or whatever. But the same impulse that made those do it is joining virtual reality and cryotechnology, cryogenics together. Now, what I want to do, and this is, I'm floating this now publicly, so I'm going to compromise some people, is the one karaoke is, I'm going to dry mouth with excitement, excuse me. Karaoke is the BBC. Code Lazarus is at Channel 4. I want the man whose head is in the box and wired up and spilling out memories of the real world that I know to be the man who is the central character of Karaoke. So what I would like, I don't have to break the thread I'm working on. I've got so many, all I hope is that I've got enough days to finish it. And I'm working all the hours I can. And I'm making I've got a GP in Ross, Paul Downey, his name, who should be celebrated if I do finish this, who has so gently and carefully led me to a balance between pain control and mental control where I can work, that he's given me the liberty and he's had the intelligence to see that I can create a space to do 10 pages a day, flat out, which is what when I go flat out, I go flat out. And believe me, with a passion I've never felt, I feel I can write anything at the moment. I feel I can fly with it. I feel like I can really communicate what I'm about and what the world, and what I feel, and what the world ought to know. Yeah, I have vocation, I have a passion about it, a conviction about it. And there's no question in my mind Michael Grade should be the Director General of the BBC. That's what it's crying out for. Anybody with any nous can see that. But whatever. I haven't had a single moment of terror since they told me. I know I'm going to die, whether it's in 4 weeks' time, 5 weeks' time, 6 weeks' time. It might be longer. I might make 8, 9, 10. Who knows? But the histology of it suggests that I should already be dead. But I know what's keeping me going. And if that passion, if those two organizations could do this, and if that will there be stars in your crown? Will there be any stars in your crown? if there could be, if they could do that, then I would have left something that, in the first case, I am proud of, because I've written so much of it I know, and I've got the same feeling that I had with Singing Detective and Pennies from Heaven, only even more so, and Blue Remembered Hills, that I would go out with a... I can now be arrogant and boastful and effort to everything. I could go out with a fitting memorial.
That was Forest of Dean television playwright Dennis Potter speaking on the 5th of April 1994 in a Without Walls programme to Melvin Bragg. More from Forest of Dean television playwright Dennis Potter after the news. With his controversial McTaggart Royal Television Society Edinburgh Lecture from 1993.